I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Eric Libby. He's an Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. He's a mathematical biologist. And we're here to talk about the special screening of the 1974 film Young Frankenstein, which screens tonight at 7 o'clock at the CCA. It's part of the Science on Screen series, which is a collaboration between the Santa Fe Institute and the CCA. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me again.
So this film is clearly a great work of science.
Obviously. It's absolutely everything in it is true, too.
That's right.
I've actually lived it.
Gene Wilder did go to Transylvania and recreate the experiments of his great-grandfather, the Dr. Frankenstein, but he disavowed his connection until he went to Transylvania and he called himself Dr. Frankenstein.
That's right.
And it's just a great movie, and I watched it last night. Was really enjoying seeing these actors, many of whom had have played with each other in various movies that were made around that time. Why did you choose it for Science on Screen?
Well, I love the Frankenstein genre. It's always been one of my favorites, and I'd wanted to do it for a while for the Science on Screen. Last time I chose Alien. But I was deciding between the original Frankenstein or the Young Frankenstein. And since I did a horror film, Alien, last time, I thought it might be best to go with comedy this time, or else I get typecast and just end up doing horror films randomly. So, and I watched it and just got a real kick out of it and thought it would be a great way of talking about science and letting people have a laugh or two.
So what is the, I mean, when you talk about the fantasy of the Frankenstein monster, it's about this really kind of ancient desire on the part of human beings to play God by animating material and turning it into life.
That's exactly why I got into science. No, I'm teasing. No, I think that actually you can take a lot from it. I actually don't think of it as much of a God tale as much as I think of it as somebody who's trying to investigate the origins of life or the origins of complex life. And so for Victor Frankenstein, he's trying to create a human or something that's very human-like. And for me, in my own research, I try to understand how things as complicated as humans evolved from something as simple, and I put simple in quotes because I think they're still quite complex, but bacteria. So I guess for me, it's an interesting take because Victor Frankenstein creates life from previously living parts, or is it deceased parts, and creates something very similar to what he recognizes. Which is something human. But for me, a lot of the research I do is trying to think of how life could have evolved from a spot. And I end up thinking about life that may not resemble anything that we see today. And so for that aspect, to me, it's kind of a nice contrast, but it's looking at sort of a similar problem. I also think that the movie has really strong evolutionary themes because in the whole lore, the monster wants Victor Frankenstein to create him a mate because otherwise his species ends, and that's all there is. And they guarantee that they'll go to South America and keep out of the way. But Victor Frankenstein is worried because, of course, if the monster is able to reproduce, then this breed of new creature might take over. And that's something incredibly evolutionary. I mean, that's the evolution of a new species, competition between species. And so those themes, I think, really appeal to me as a scientist, specifically someone who studies what I study.
It is funny that South America is considered out of the way.
Yeah, that's right. That's where Darwin goes, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's not Europe.
Right. So there is also, I mean, you know, in Young Frankenstein, they take the body of the deceased criminal in which they're also transplanting the brain of what was supposed to be a
genius.
A great historian who actually lived.
Mm.
I looked him up. He was
right.
A German military historian.
That doesn't surprise me.
But they put that brain in, but the brain is lost by Igor. Played by the inimitable Marty Feldman. Mm. I mean, what a crazy actor and crazy looking guy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But anyway, so they transplant instead, by mistake, unbeknownst to Dr. Frankenstein, the brain of an abnormal person who Igor thought was somebody named Abby Normal.
That's right. That's right. That's right. I can definitely identify. I sympathize for all the Abby Normal people.
Exactly. But you've got this creature on the roof, and it is the lightning from the lightning storms atop the hill castle in Transylvania that actually does the animating. And I wondered, I mean, whether that speaks at all to anything realistic about the role of electricity in human life and the human circuitry.
Well, I can say that my worst moments as a scientist are when lightning strikes the computer. So it's exactly the opposite. But I am familiar that people are looking at the notion that these high voltage electricity strikes was able to create new carbon compounds that then could be used by origins of early life. I don't specifically study that, so it's kind of outside my area of expertise. So I think it's very wise that no one lets me play with electricity or lightning. I think that was decided at a very early age, actually.
When you put your fork in the outlet?
That's right. That's right. That's why there's a white stripe going through my head.
Lots of people have done it and lived to tell the tale and gone on to be scientists.
Absolutely. But I think there's a reason I do mathematical biology. I think if you like to cook, then you're always used to tasting something. That's a really bad philosophy to have in a microbiology lab.
So let's talk a little bit about what you do as a mathematical biologist and what you're working on now at the Institute.
Sure. So in my field, I look at the evolution of biological complexity. And what I mean by that is once again, how you get complex organisms to have evolved from very simple organisms. I use a lot of computers and mathematical models, and I work with experimentalists who are looking at very simple bacteria or yeast system and are trying to evolve more complex type of entities. And so what they do is they take these bacteria or yeast and put them into lab settings that are designed to select for something kind of interesting. So for example, there's one where these yeast who are single-celled are put into a tube, and at the very end of growing, after, you know, a few days, they spin it and they select something from the bottom. And in order to make it through the spinning, you kind of have to be big. So what happens is these yeast very quickly evolve to form these multicellular organisms that look kind of like snowflakes. And if you keep doing this process, they start evolving other traits. So they evolve a form of death, which enables them to split and actually reproduce much faster. And then they start changing their cell size, so they become bigger cells, and then they change the way the snowflake is structured. And so I work with these guys to try to understand how these different traits evolved, why they evolved, and to offer some sort of prediction of where it might go in the future.
Did you say evolve a form of death?
Yeah, that's right. Well, they have a natural form of death, but they increase the rate of death by at least 10 to 100-fold. So they're dying way more frequently than they should. And this type of death is a programmed cell death, so it's apoptosis. So they die after a certain amount of time, and they run out of nutrients and the like. And by increasing this rate of death, they're able to break apart these snowflakes because they sort of just split different branches. And as the snowflakes split apart, they're able to actually grow many more snowflakes and actually grow many more cells. And so it's actually quite a beneficial trait.
It's interesting that when we think about evolution, survival is sort of the key word, and evolving a form of death or a rate of death to be adaptive makes you think that it's not about the individuals, it's about their kind of community.
That's right, and I think that's the argument that we had to use at least to try to explain this. But in other work, I'm looking at a type of bacteria that can switch between two different types, and this is related to antibiotic resistance, but it's also related to any type of single-celled organism that switches between states. And the switching between states can be a developmental program. It could be some adaptation. But what we find is the strategy that's best for long-term survival is actually quite bad at competition and vice versa. And the thing is, in these environments, competition is key. So what ends up happening is you can set up the competition so that one strain wins and then dominates all other strains, drives them all extinct. it becomes the only one, and then it quickly goes extinct because it's not designed to survive. And on the few off chances that the other one wins, which is very rare, but when it wins, it's designed for survival, and it can stay around as long as it wants. So it's kind of interesting, actually, these conflicting drives for competition and potentially survival.
Now, when you're doing experiments like this in a laboratory setting, it's fundamentally different from the whatever it is, the primordial soup or the oceans or whatever that these creatures evolved in. Does it, how do I say this? Let me just formulate the question. Presumably they were swimming around with lots of other little things which in turn affect their survival and reproduction and their lives in some way. So, I mean, does it, the fact that you're that you don't have them in a natural setting, how does that affect what conclusions you can draw from the work?
Yeah, it's incredibly complicated. I mean, most of these microorganisms that we're calling simple are not simple at all. They're living with many other different types of microorganisms, exchanging all sorts of things, and we can't culture most of them in the lab. And the reason we can't take them and grow them in the lab is because they're reliant on a whole bunch of other things. And it's, loosely related as if you took a human and tried to sort of reproduce the human in some sort of lab setting, but you forgot some of the food that they need, or, you know, you forgot the fact that they might need protein or fat, and so you don't have it in their diet, and all of a sudden they're unhealthy, and you wonder what's going on. And that's kind of parallel to what's happening with these microorganisms. Now, within the lab, so once again, I don't do lab experiments for very good reasons, for the sake of humanity, I think, actually. But
what do you mean?
Oh, I just mean that I'm a horrific lab person. I mean, even today, I was trying to do something. We got some sort of grow your own bioluminescent dinoflagellates, and I'm a complete disaster at this. And my wife, who used to be an experimental biologist, was just horrified at my lab technique.
They sound nice.
They sound really nice, but I'm very good at killing them, despite my best efforts and their robustness. But
Well, wait a minute. So what do you do? If you're talking about growing yeast and spinning them...
These are my collaborators, who are also much better at this than I am. But the idea is that it's so complicated to take a whole community of these organisms that what you try to do is you try to take one component and understand how that component works in isolation and then start building and adding communities. So I work with somebody else that is looking at single-celled algae that can evolve to be multi-celled, but is looking at this within a system where he adds a predator. And so he's looking at just a simple two-organism system. And I think that for us, it's very much kind of a bottom-up approach where you kind of have to... It's so complicated at the top that you have to start with just small pieces and see how they interact and come up with general rules that might apply and then start adding things and seeing what happens. In general, with the type of things I do, this seems to work decently well, like within the mathematical modeling. If you can look at and understand how a couple of things interact, as you add a few more, they tend to follow those same sorts of rules, and you can make decent predictions, I think.
So what's the math part of it? Like, what's your role?
So why am I useful?
Well, if you've got such bad lab
tests. Oh, I know. I know. Well, it's because so much of biology now is quantitative. I mean, you really need to sort of know how things are interacting to be able to make predictions, and you have to sort of know growth rates and numbers. So what I do is I take these models, I make mathematical models of their systems, of their experiments, and I try to search over different ranges of parameters. And by that I mean I look at many different values of things like growth rates or probabilities of doing things and try to make predictions of what types of behavior you should see based on this. So I'm able to search a larger range of possibilities than they can do in the lab because they just don't have that information. Or it takes a long time to learn a particular value of something and try to understand, even if it were important. So often I'm there to try to say, okay, well, in these types of systems, if we think that they're doing these 10 behaviors, actually these only two behaviors are the ones that matter, and these are the ones you should probably measure to see what's going to happen. So that type of contribution is what I'm good at.
We're talking to mathematical biologist Eric Libby. Now, you were talking a moment ago about little tiny organisms that switch from one state to another?
That's right.
What does that mean? What are we talking about?
Yeah, sure. So salmonella would be a good example. So salmonella has two different types of compounds it can put in its flagella, the thing that lets it move. And our immune system can target one or the other one of these. So what salmonella does is it does something known as bet hedging, where when it reproduces, it might produce one type of compound or the other. And there's no real difference between them except the fact that our immune system can only target one at a time. And so what happens is by kind of diversifying and bet hedging, it means that if the immune system decides to attack one compound, then all of the salmonella with the other compound can survive and are able to go on in the future. And this type of strategy is incredibly common in the microbial world. Also in plants, they do it a little bit differently, and presumably higher organisms.
What would that look like in higher organisms?
That's a great question, but I'm much more focused on smaller things. I'm not so good with larger things or lab.
Okay.
But with plants, it's because, you know, very few plants breed true. So they generate a whole bunch of different seeds, and the seeds look very different from the parent. And you can think of this in terms of why we graft so many plants. And, you know, you find a good pear or something, you then grow that and then start grafting branches onto other pear trees to get them to produce a similar type of pear.
So when you have a pear tree, it produces seeds whose, if they were to all grow into trees, would produce significantly different pears from the parent tree?
So when you say significantly, I would probably be a little bit more conservative on that and say different, but they won't be exactly like the parent. And so if you had an entire orchard and you had some pears that you really liked, the only way to ensure that you can still propagate these types of pears is to graft the branches. And that
so the growing seeds is not sufficient.
Is not as successful, that's right. And it depends on the plant, but it's because these plants do this type of bet hedging or diversification, where they're generating a whole bunch of different seeds, and some of them are similar to the parents, and some of them are incredibly different, and it depends on weather, soil, variability, all sorts of things that will determine ultimately which one's successful.
I guess it's like every mammal, too, produces offspring that are different from the parents.
I think the offspring at least hope they're different from the parents.
Are you speaking from experience?
I'm not going to say anything on that matter.
So, believe it or not, we're talking about the film Young Frankenstein, which was made in 1974 with an incredible cast. I mean, let's just talk about the movie for a moment. I mean, Gene Wilder, one of the greatest performers, in my view, of our time. He's so expressive and so naturally funny in this role and in so many of the roles he does.
Yeah, he does a nice mix, too, of whimsy and severity, and that's really useful in comedy.
It's
a really great cast, and there's also some great moments that are related to science in terms of just the humor. For example, there's this one scene in where he sort of goes in this long speech about how as a scientist you must accept your failures with serenity and quiet dignity. And then just loses it, you know, just starts swearing and throwing things and yelling, why won't you work? And boy, I can identify with that.
That's funny. And then Igor goes, serenity and grace, yes.
Yes, exactly. and it's nice because it takes that genre and it, you know, it tries to recreate it because it's filmed in black and white. But it really is a complete satire of this and makes fun of lots of aspects of it and makes it a lot more lighthearted, whereas, you know, it also at the same time is able to kind of put you in the shoes of somebody whose ancestor had done something what most people thought was horrific and everyone is kind of expecting him to lose it, and sure enough, he tries so hard not to, and then
right.
When you're in the castle, and there's all these great books, and yeah.
Like Oedipus walks into his fate,
no matter how hard
he tries not to.
Exactly. And then just embraces it.
And then the actress Madeline Kahn, whose background is an opera singer, come out
yes,
during the course of the film.
Oh, she's... Yeah. She's perfect for that role.
She's a piece of work.
For sure, absolutely. And she deserves exactly what happens to her, I think.
Right.
She was a bit of a monster and ends up with a monster, so it works out well.
And then Terry Garr, who had a long career, and she was very young in this role.
Oh, yeah.
And again, the perfect lab assistant with a kind of fake German accent.
Yeah, absolutely. With the roll in the hay. Where right. She's literally rolling in hay.
Right, in the back of the wagon that takes them to the castle. No, it's a terrific movie, and sometimes you watch movies from the 70s and they just don't age well, but this is a cult classic.
Yeah, and you know, I honestly thought the same thing with Alien, and I thought that there's a lot of science fiction films that kind of lose a little bit over the years, but it was a film that really holds up quite well, and I think Young Frankenstein is very similar. I don't think there's anything quite like it within the Frankenstein genre, and it's made its mark, and it still is. Its jokes are still applicable, and I mean, they were sort of quite general. It wasn't time specific at all. And no, it's a really nice contrast.
So the film screens tonight at 7 o'clock. It's part of the Science on Screen series, which is a wonderful ongoing collaboration between the Santa Fe Institute and the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Now, you will be introducing the film and then doing Q&A at the end?
That's right, and it's part of the national event. I think this is National Science on Screen Day or something like that.
Is that right?
Yeah, so many theaters across the country will be doing different scientific films with people introducing them, yeah.
I wonder if anybody else is doing Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Eric Libby, mathematical biologist, Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for having me again, and I hope to see you there.
Excellent.